My name is Veruska Calabri and I'm here today to interview Trixie Blair on the 7th of July 2010 on behalf of the Wellcome Trust. And we are really here to discuss your time on the plinth, Trixie.
Right, fine.
So thank you very much for coming today. So I wanted to remind you about your performance on the plinth. Mm. I know you went up there to talk about ageism.
Yes.
I have listened to your pre-plinth interview and I have some questions to ask you about your life story. But first of all, how has it been like since you've been on the plinth? How do you remember the event?
Very exciting. It was at 4 in the morning. So it wasn't the best time of the day because it was pitch dark, being October the 4th. But it does stand out in my memory because I'm not good with dates, but October the 4th I'll never forget. And I had my family with me. They all came up for the event and also one friend. Otherwise, there wasn't much of an audience. But it didn't matter. There were a few people. I think there was one particular person who was there for everybody, every night. I remember it as being very exciting, and all my friends and family were very excited for me. And lots of people have sort of looked at the website since and wrote comments. So it was very memorable.
Are we talking about the One and Other website here?
Yes, we are.
So how many comments did you get?
Oh, probably not as many as lots of other people, but I would say about 15 that I can remember. I haven't looked recently if there have been any more. And there are lots of other people who, you know, who viewed the website and actually looked at the whole hour, but didn't write a comment. And there are people still asking me now, you know, what was it like? Can you send me the link? I haven't checked for a month or so whether it's still there. But, so I don't know, is it still there, the website? Yes, so you can still look at it. Yes, very exciting. I was very pleased. And lots of people, the Citizens Advice Bureau where I volunteer, thought it was a fantastic thing to do and mentioned it in their newsletter. And we are members of a liberal Jewish synagogue and they were delighted for me, you know, very interested in it and have made me do other projects as an outcome of this, about all the people for the community there. So It's the only thing that I've ever done where I've been a so-called activist, you know. And I think it's probably because I'm old now that I didn't mind doing it. And lots of people said, how did you dare? But I think there's a little side of me that's an exhibitionist. I quite enjoyed being over there.
So why this topic of ageism? When did you begin to have an interest?
Back in, I think, around the later part of the 1970s, we lived up in Keele in Staffordshire, and I had done research, I had done research in the 70s for the London School of Economics on an organisation called Task Force, which was a voluntary organisation at the time, which put young people in touch with older people. And I was part of a team that was evaluating the effectiveness of Task Force. So probably that was my first contact with older people. And then when we moved up to Keele in Staffordshire, by chance I came in contact with this charitable organisation called the Bess Johnson Foundation. And I got the post of research officer there. And we ran lots of conferences and discussions on improving the quality of life of older people. And as a result of that, I started lecturing, as a tutor counselor for the Open University on a course called An Aging Population. And I did that for a few years. And then I became a teacher. So then my interest in older people stopped, if you like. I wasn't doing anything about it. But now, as I've reached that age myself again, I'm obviously very interested in it from a personal point of view. And when I came across this lecture by Julia Neuberger, I thought she said in the lecture and in her book exactly what I had always felt about aging. So when I got the opportunity to stand on the plinth, it was the theme of ageism was about one of two or three things I thought about. And then I decided that I would focus on ageism while I stood on the plinth.
Just to summarize, what were the things that resonated with you about what Julian, this writer, was saying about ageism?
Well, she thought that, and I agree, I always thought this, that the reason why older people were not treated so well in society and why there was a lot of discrimination against older people and so on, was because there was never any self-help movement in this country. So whereas in America there was the Grey Panthers movement back in the 70s, we've never had an equivalent over here. And I always thought that was to do with social class differences. I could be totally wrong, and I see that from the point of view of a sociologist, a subject I lectured in for over 20 years, that maybe it's to do with the fact that I do think the UK is a very class-ridden society, and I think older people who are middle class are okay, so they've got no reason to form a self-help group, and the older people who are very disadvantaged are probably those who are less affluent and have less money, and therefore they probably have not so much potential or self-confidence to form self-help groups for themselves. And so I think that's one key reason why there is more ageism here perhaps than in other countries, because although there is very effective organizations like Help the Aged and Age Concern, which is now Age UK, I think it's different to have an organization acting for, on behalf of people, rather than, a particular group acting on behalf of itself. So when I stood on the plinth, I really thought maybe we should have such a self-help organization, but it needs a champion. And it seems that nobody wants to be this champion. So it lacks a leadership figure.
Going back to the experience on the plinth, since we interviewed you before you went up, we don't know what it was like when you were up there and soon after when you came down. Do you remember how you were feeling?
Up there, I felt really frustrated because I had prepared what I wanted to say really carefully, and I had rehearsed it at home with Eric, my husband. I stood on the garden table in the garden with my props, and I declaimed everything to him, and we did think that it could be raining at the time when I was actually on the plinth, so all my props, like my I had laminated sheets with the 10 points in Julia Neuberger's book, with things like saying that stop ageism at work. So we had it laminated, so if it rains, it wouldn't affect it. But what we hadn't thought of, that it could be very windy. So while I was up there, all my props were blowing away the whole time. So I remember running after these props and, that the wind was blowing in different directions. So that was my main frustration up there. And I was so keen to deliver everything that I wanted to deliver that I didn't really spend any time enjoying being up there And in the end, I ran out of time, so I had to garble the rest of what I wanted to say. But it was, so I wasn't scared of being up there. It was lovely to be up there, but I was focused on delivering my message. And so it was a little bit frustrating when the wind was so strong.
Talking about the project as a whole, did you follow it as you went along?
Yes, I did, yes. Before it and after it as well. And I spent a lot of time looking at people before me, what they had said. And I used to look at the weekly summary of the most interesting slots that people had done. I used to think some of them are wonderfully summarized, and used to have great fun watching them, especially the ones who were streaking. I thought it was hilarious. It was great fun, really very, very entertaining and very special to be part of such a project.
Do you think having an online community following this project and participating in a way by making comments on people's profiles had an effect on what you chose to do?
You mean afterwards or beforehand? Or
before.
Before. I don't think so. No, no. I mean, I did look at what other people had done, but I don't think that influenced my choice of topic for when I was up there.
Did you participate in this online community in terms of making comments on other profiles?
No, because I'm not that IT orientated. You know, I can do what I need to do, but I'm not part of any IT community at all. So I now use, well, obviously I use email. And I am on Facebook because my son-in-law put me on there, but I'm not into online communities at all, really. I'm too old.
Were you aware that there were a couple of virtual communities of the Plinfers on Twitter?
No.
And Facebook?
No, I had no idea, no. I think that's a fantastic outcome. Really is interesting.
Okay, just now to move towards the experience as a whole, what do you think was the impact for you on a personal level?
I think it's given me a lot of self-confidence to feel that it was something I was able to do. I'm not good at speaking in public, so it may have helped me that it was at 4 a.m. and I knew there was nobody there. But nevertheless, the fact that I applied to do it, I got it, and I went through with it, and I prepared for it, has given me a lot of self-confidence that I haven't had before.
Do you think it changed you then in any fundamental way?
No, no. I couldn't claim that it's changed me fundamentally, but it has empowered me. Yes, I think it was an empowering experience. I'm not afraid of speaking out now. I think it is partly to do with aging anyway, but it is also the experience of having done it. I know I did it, so it was very good, very grateful for the opportunity.
Now, to bring you back to your life story, as you mentioned to us that you and your family were refugees from the 1956 Hungarian Revolution. I know you said to my colleague in the previous interview that you didn't know really what was going on at the time. Because of course your parents didn't feel comfortable to tell you about the repression and so on. I wonder at what point did your parents explain to you what had happened and what story they passed down to you?
They never did. And I think that's had a very lasting impact on me. They were not child-centered. I think probably many parents at the time were not child-centered. And I actually remember, because my father reminded me, that one of the questions I asked on the way to England, are we coming to England because we are going to have more money here? And he just laughed. I think he laughed because he didn't understand why I should be concerned about that, or he didn't really understand that I would need to know why we were coming here. Because he knew why he was coming here, he thought it was sort of self-understood, whereas I never understood it, because, I'm not sure if I mentioned this in my previous interview, in Hungary, this was during the communist times, during the Russian occupation, we were taught that England was an awful country to come to, because it was, there were always strikes there, you know, the workers were exploited. So I couldn't understand why on earth would we want to come to a place like that. And my father, and I suppose my mum as well, in just because they knew why we were coming, it didn't occur to them that they would have needed to explain why we were coming.
During the revolution in 56, do you recall any memories of that time yourself?
Oh, very clear memory, very, very clear memories. First memory was of, apparently a teacher escorted me home the day that the revolution broke out from school. That was on the 23rd of October, 1956. And then I remember that we had to stay at home. It was too dangerous to go outside. We lived on the third floor of an apartment block bang in the middle of Budapest. And there was a cellar, and we went down to the cellar to make sure that if need be, we could go down there and stay there. My grandmother had a big brown box. I never knew what was in it, but she actually opened it up, and yeah, I still sometimes think about it today. She had in there tins of food, which either had been there since the Second World War, or maybe what perhaps relatives had sent to Hungary from America, I don't know, but it was the provision there in case there was no food available. And then one day, a few days later, the tanks came rolling down our street, and we were up in the flat, and my parents must have said, just lie flat on your tummy, and we all just lay flat on our tummies, because they were shooting into the houses. But luckily, when they past our house, they only shot with a machine gun, not actually with a tank. And so there were lots and lots of holes, machine gun holes in the wall, but none actually got into our flat. That's the worst moment that I can remember. And then I can remember eventually we were allowed out of the house, and I can remember crossing the road and going past a Russian soldier who shouted out, "Davai, davai," that's the only Russian word I know, which is go away. And then eventually, when we went for walks, you could see so many parts of Budapest just crumbled and houses shattered. And I think what was very memorable, that people were buried in parks, anyone who was killed was buried there and then in a park, and a little wooden cross was there. But luckily didn't know anyone personally who was killed. We had a maid, and the maid's son died fighting in this revolution. So that did have an enormous impact. I remember it so clearly still now. And I think my parents thought straight away about escaping. Loads of Hungarians were escaping then, and they never talked about it to me, because they never talked to me about anything. I think because they were scared that I would tell other people at school. And so all I knew was that one night we had packed some suitcases and my mum had a rucksack and my into which they cut two holes for my sister because she was so little. So she was put in the rucksack with her two legs dangling out. And just as we were due to leave, because we were going to escape through the border and the Russians were there already, we had heard that the particular route we were going to take had been discovered, so we couldn't leave then. And so we left about a month or so later because my father had a passport to visit Western Europe. He had been out the year before. And I think he paid someone to write my mum's name and our two names into his passport. And we were allowed out as for a sort of holiday, in inverted commas, to Vienna. So we left Hungary with about three or four suitcases. They did bring out my bike. I don't know why. But we just had to leave the whole flat. We had a very beautiful flat, as I recall it, everything in it, and go. And so we arrived to Vienna, I think on the 19th of January, 1957. And my parents had friends in Vienna, and they must have booked us a room in a hotel, because the next thing I remember is that the first day we were there, and I had no idea what was going on, my parents went out because I think they had to register somewhere as refugees. But they didn't even tell me that. They left me there in the hotel room with my sister. And they didn't come back, and they didn't come back, and they didn't come back. And then a waiter brought us some food around lunchtime. And I had no idea what was going on. And then eventually my parents turned up in the evening. And I think it was because they had to queue a long time. But I just remember this feeling of being forlorn, you know, in a strange place. I couldn't speak the language. And I didn't know what was going on. And that sort of experience, well, I had been used to that experience back in Hungary because they never told me anything. And it kept on repeating itself. So the effect of all that has been that I'm very insecure, incredibly insecure, caused by experiences like that.
You mentioned in the previous interview that you lived with your family in a refugee camp in Vienna for a few months.
Yes, it wasn't in Vienna. What happened then was that my father, who was a lawyer in Hungary, got a job in an office through friends that we had, or a relative. But we had no money, absolutely no money, because we couldn't bring anything out. So it was thought that it was best for my mum, myself and my sister to go and stay in a refugee camp. And this refugee camp was in a very beautiful place outside Vienna, in an area, well, the place was called Bad Kreuzen. And I was, as I was sort of 10 and a half, I thought this was a wonderful place because it was up in the mountains. It was a hotel that had been converted by the Swedish Red Cross to a refugee camp, and there were loads of young kids. I mean, the accommodation wasn't nice because in the hotel rooms they had put bunk beds, and there were loads of families in a big room with bunk beds. But my mum and I and my sister got a little attic room all to ourselves. And I remember sort of, I think I became my mum's helper, if you like, because my mum had a very privileged upbringing before the Second World War. And they always had maids and so on. So she wasn't used to the hard life. And if I remember the journey to the camp, I remember we had to go through with buses and we had to walk, and my mum was carrying Sophie, my sister, and I was carrying the suitcases. And then in this little attic room, I would help taking up, I don't know whether it was coal or wood for the stove and so on. But apart from those sort of things, I had a nice time because I had lots of young kids and I liked playing with them. And I remember things like the Swedish Red Cross tried to organize lots of activities. There could have been lots of maybe English volunteers, because I remember being taught an English song called London Burning, London Burning. I couldn't speak any English then. And then the other thing I remember is, as we didn't have many clothes, only the ones we came out with, lots of people from all over the world had donated clothes. And so I remember going into a room where my mother chose clothes for me, and I'll never forget a grey cardigan with red decorations on it, which I couldn't stand, but I had to wear it. And then what happened next was, there was a nearby village, and we sometimes went into the village, and if we were very lucky, we bought a chocolate bar. You know, I remember that. And then my sister caught measles, and my mum couldn't cope with that, so she telephoned my father, and my father came and collected us and took us back to Vienna. And there, I don't know how, we rented a room in somebody's flat. She was called Frau Dr. Ullmann. And we lived in this bedsit for another few months until it was decided where we were going to come next. So my parents knew they didn't want to stay in Vienna, but they wanted to go to the States where we had relatives, but they didn't manage to get on the quota. They only took a quota of refugees. And then the second choice was Canada, and they didn't get onto the quota there either. So England was our third choice, and the parents could speak English, and they had friends in England who helped them to find jobs here before we arrived. And so we actually came to England with them having work permits to work here. But I do remember still at the refugee camp, on certain days you'd see a whole lot of coaches arriving. One coach would say Canada, another coach would say Australia, another coach would say, I don't know, Belgium. And people would get onto these coaches from the refugee camp and go off to these countries from there. Obviously, as a kid, I never thought twice about this. Is all normal, because what happens to you as a child is all normal. It's only sort of maybe objectively looking back now that it seems, gosh, that was strange.
Just to bring you back to what you mentioned about not talking to your parents about what happened, or they not talking to you about it. Mm. I'm really struck by the very lucid recall of all of these events. Mm. Have you ever approached them about it and talked to them about it?
No, I haven't, because, and of course they are dead now, but I was always very scared of my father. He was not an easy person to talk to. My mum was an easy person to talk to, but she was very timid. And I suppose I modeled myself on her for many years. And I never really talked to her, because there were other... She was very sensitive. I don't know if I said in the other interview, I had a brother who died in Hungary who was 18 months younger than me. And she never really recovered from that. And so one was very protective towards my mother because, you know, you knew she could get upset quite quickly. But yes, I was, I don't know why I never rebelled. It never occurred to me to object to anything that happened to me, never ever. And I don't know if I said in my previous interview that as an adult, I've had a lot of therapy, psychotherapy over, 15, 20 years. And I know that my psychotherapist often said, and why didn't you say no? Why didn't you say, I'm not doing that? But it never even occurred to me that I could do that. So whatever was thrown at me, I just went with it.
Thank you for sharing that with me. Just to bring you back again to this time when you came to England, do you remember the journey?
Indeed, very clearly. We came on a train, and I remember we did have couchettes, so there were beds. And what I remember is I think my father slept with my sister, and as she was only 18 months old, she wetted the bed that he's never let anyone forget. And then I remember crossing over to England by boat. I mean, I had no idea, seeing that he just laughed when I asked why we were coming. So I didn't know why we were coming here. And on this boat, you know, crossing the channel, all I remember is the grey sky, there was a very nice Englishman that was terribly nice to us on a boat, and obviously realized we were refugees, and he bought us a sandwich, and I've never forgotten that he gave us this sandwich, and all he had in it was a lettuce leaf. And I thought, what peculiar country am I coming to where a sandwich is two pieces of bread and a lettuce leaf? And then we arrived to Dover, and I remember that we were taken obviously to some immigration office where we spent a long time because I suppose we all had to have medicals. And then we got on the train, and I remember in darkness we arrived to Victoria. And I remember coming on the train and thinking, God, I don't like this place. And I hated it. I hated England for many years. I somehow took an instant dislike to it because I suppose I must have felt that I was forced to come here. I didn't want to come here. I liked my life in Hungary as a child, and I didn't understand why I had to leave it behind. When we arrived at Victoria Station, there was quite a deputation waiting for us because my parents had lots of friends here who had come here after the Second World War, so they didn't hang around in Hungary till 1956. And they had already found us a bedsit in Muswell Hill in North London. And they all kissed us and hugged us. I didn't have a clue who they were. Probably gave us little presents and stuck us in a taxi. And I remember going through, I think we passed probably what is Selfridges, and travelled for an hour to Muswell Hill from Victoria, and then we arrived to this house which was owned by a Hungarian lady who had let out lots of her rooms in her house to other Hungarian refugees. So it was what would be a sort of five-bedroom detached house somewhere, but with loads of families living there, and we had a bedsit. And I think I spent the first night in the same room as my parents and my sister. And then the second night she said, why don't you put Trixie in my bedroom? You know, you'll have more space in that room. And I did spend the night in her bedroom. And the whole thing was so alien to me that obviously my parents could see that that was a bit too much. And so I moved back into their room. And I remember in this house doing the family washing in the bathroom because I actually knew more about washing and cooking and ironing than my mum did because I had spent a lot of time with the maid and I knew how to do these things as my mum did. And then I think after a few months, we my father became an article clerk in an office, in a solicitor's office, and my mum went to work in a chemical factory because she was a chemist, and my sister got put into a nursery, which she hated, and I got taken to a convent, probably the day after, which the friends here had found for me. But again, I had never seen a convent, I had never seen any nuns, and it was completely bewildering to be taken there, and I was just dumped there. It was in Bayswater, so rather far away from Muswell Hill, and I've got very strong memories of my first few months there as well.
He did mention something about it in the pre-plinth interview, and in fact there's something that I really wanted to ask you about, your identity as Jewish and what it was like back home, whether your parents practice Jewish rituals at home in Hungary, and whether you were brought up as a Jewish person yourself.
No. I was brought up as nothing, because they were not practicing Jews. They belonged to sort of an upper middle class elite, where I think probably a lot of their friends were Jewish, but they were not practicing at all. I think during the communist times they thought it was best for me not to know that I had a religion even, but it wasn't important to them. It was never important to them, except that of course they suffered because of it, because they were in hiding in Budapest during the Second World War, and because they were Jewish. But they never talked about it, never ever talked about it when I was a child. And the only reason I knew that I was Jewish, I may have known, but I don't think I really took it in, was when the maid said to me, "Do you know you are Jewish and you killed Jesus?" So I remember that. But otherwise, I have no recollection of being anything, except I think I knew I was christened a Catholic, because many Jews then, after the Second World War, thought that, and this was on my mum's side, her own mother, thought, why prolong this handicap of being Jewish? You know, what if there is another persecution? You know, say it would be better for us all to become Christian. So on my mum's side, everybody got christened, but it didn't mean anything. We didn't practice anything, didn't believe in it. So I think, but because of that, because I was christened a Catholic, when we got to England, the friends here had approached something called the Catholic Women's League, and they paid for me to go to this convent, which was a private school, and that seemed important to everybody, because I had missed the 11 plus, so I would have gone to a secondary modern school here, and they obviously all thought that was not a good idea, as I couldn't speak English. So they thought the best option was to send me to this convent, and that's how I ended up there. There was a Hungarian nun who took me under her wings, and I did my first communion and confession and confirmation, and I became a very strong Catholic for many years.
We touched upon the issue of identity earlier before we began recording, and I just wonder whether you'd like to talk about that, what it was like for you arriving here in a place that was completely different and alien to you, and then becoming more accustomed to the way of life, if you were able to trace that for me.
Sure. I think when I arrived, myself felt very strongly Hungarian, and in fact that stayed with me ever since, because it's very strange for, I think, an 11-year-old. So when I left, and I'm now 64, and I still have this very strong Hungarian identity, I think that must be quite unusual. But I don't now feel I'm Hungarian. Well, I do and I don't. because I think I became very confused on many levels. I hated being here, so I didn't want to acquire an English identity. I didn't want to lose my accent. And obviously I regret that now. I wish I could speak English without an accent. It would be very convenient to be able to switch it on and off, because even now people say, "Oh, where are you from?" And I say, "I'm from Hungary." And they expect me to say then, when they ask me, "Oh, how long have you been here?" They expect me to say, "Oh, 5 years." So I've been here over 50 years. But my accent is still so strong. So I think that is because I didn't want to get rid of it at the time. And now I can't. I never felt English. And I still have problems with it now about identity on that level, because obviously when we came out, that we really thought, and I grew up thinking that I could never ever ever go back to Hungary because there was the Iron Curtain. So I felt this tremendous sense of loss, and I used to dream that one day I'll wake up in my bed back in my flat in Hungary. And then when unexpectedly the Iron Curtain came down, the Prehistorica in 89, we then went back because we couldn't go back because we were political refugees, and my father always thought it would be too dangerous to go back. But when we did go back then, it was completely traumatic for me because I never thought I'd ever, ever see Hungary again. So it was completely unreal. And we've now been back lots of times, and it's only now that I'm beginning to come to terms with the fact that I'm neither English nor Hungarian. So when I speak Hungarian now, I've got a very strong English accent, and my Hungarian is at the level of an 11-year-old child and not an adult. And there's not one language that I can speak perfectly. So I feel sort of stateless. I think I've always felt stateless. But it's just now, when I'm getting really old, that I can acknowledge that my parents were right to bring me here, and I'm lucky to be living here rather than in Hungary, because objectively I can see that I'm much better off here in every sense of the way, stability and so on. But emotionally, I've always resented having to be here. They loved being here, absolutely loved being here. And in spite of the fact that I've got my children and my grandchildren here, I'm only just now coming to terms with the fact that, you know, I'm British. I've been British for 50 years, and that's not a bad thing to be. And then, of course, I've also got identity problems regarding religion, because of having been nothing, then having been a very devout Catholic, and then by chance I met Eric, my husband, at university. We were students together, and he comes from an Orthodox Jewish background, and his parents accepted me because they knew that I was Jewish by origin. And now more and more I'm part of his identity. Well, so I do feel Jewish, but not at all as a believer, and only as sort of ethnic origin wise. And now I feel in the liberal synagogue that we go to sometimes, I feel reasonably at home there, because there are lots of other people in my situation there who have come from Europe, some part of Europe, and have made England their country. But I don't believe in Judaism as a religion, so I suppose I see myself as an agnostic. So I've always seen myself, identity-wise, as totally confused, just confused. But I think because of all these different experiences, I think on the plus side is that I'm very able to empathize with other people from similar backgrounds, you know, who've also got problems of identity, of have come from different cultures and have got to get used to a new culture.
Just a question around the One and Other project. One of Gormley's main ideas was to get a measurement of the UK today, you who occupies the UK today. So where would you say you fit into all of that?
Well, Britain, since I've arrived, it has become a really multicultural society, which is fantastic. So whereas I really felt like an outsider when I arrived, and I sometimes did have the feeling that people looked down on me because I had an accent, I feel that I fit in perfectly now, absolutely perfectly, because especially living around here, we are all part of a very multicultural society. I must say, when I lived in Keene in Staffordshire, I did feel like someone from the moon. But down here in Watford and in London, I feel that I fit in perfectly, and there is no prejudice against me because society has changed so much. So it feels very comfortable now.
Presumably you have returned to Budapest?
Yes, many times. Yes.
Can you recount the first time?
It was really traumatic. It was very funny because we went with other friends. We went in two cars and we got to the border and we crossed the border in our car and we stopped to have a picnic somewhere near the border, and there was a playground. And at that time, my two daughters must have been, I can't remember exactly, but maybe 10 and 14. 10-year-old, or she may have been smaller, went on a seesaw, which was really decrepit, and she twisted her ankle. And so we then spent the rest of the stay in Budapest in and out of hospitals with her. And she and I are emotionally very close. There's a very strong bond between us. And I almost think, and I think she agrees, that it may have been almost subconsciously on purpose, so that I wouldn't have this terrible experience. You know, I'd have something else to preoccupy me while I was in Budapest, rather than this just this awful traumatic experience of being back there. It didn't seem real. I remember, because I had spent so many years visiting other countries in Europe and saying, gosh, this reminds me of Hungary, the pavements, the cobblestones, or the food is like food I had in Hungary, or this building looks like a building in Budapest. So when I was actually back in Budapest, I said, this looks very much like Budapest. And it was very hard to actually think this really is Budapest, rather than just something that is like Budapest, because I had spent all these years thinking that I would never, ever, ever see it again. And it has taken lots of visits back to be able to feel fairly normal. But it still gives me a huge kick when I arrive back there. And I think if we had lots and lots of money, we would buy a flat in Budapest. But I mean, we can't afford it, so we don't. But it does give me a huge kick to go back there. And I have this terribly romantic feeling, you know, I see Hungary as it was when I was back then at age 10, because I am lucky in having a best friend who was my neighbor, a girl, and we are in very close contact now. And obviously her experiences of Hungary are the real experiences of what it's like to be in Hungary, and she knows I've got this fantasized world of what Hungary is like, rather than the reality.
What happened to your home in Hungary?
Well, that was quite interesting, because it was then, we gave it to some very distant relations, because housing was a big issue, and so they were delighted to get this lovely flat in the middle of Budapest. And then I can't remember if I said anything about this in the previous interview, but once I had an aunt who went back to Budapest when we still couldn't, and she went to visit these relatives, and she apparently went around the flat taking paintings of the wall and saying, well, I'll take these out to, you know, Trixie and family in London because it's theirs. And of course they called the police. It was ours, but we had left it behind. Anyway, so she wasn't allowed to bring anything out of this flat. And the consequence of that was that they wouldn't let anyone in into this flat. And I've always wanted to go and see it. And I remember each time we went back, we'd go and stand opposite the house and I'd look up to the bedroom where I thought I'd wake up one morning. And I was dying to see it, and we couldn't see it. And then the very last time I'd been back, almost the last time, that was, I think it was last year or the year before, we went with some friends for a few days, and we walked past the house, and there was a for sale sign up by our flat. And I thought, oh my God, I got to go and see it. And so we rang the estate agent. We were very naughty. We pretended we wanted to buy it. And so we went to see it. And it's been wonderful for me to be able to see it because it was totally different. I could recognize bits of it, but obviously the people who had lived in it since had furnished it differently. And there was a lady whose mother had lived in that flat there to speak with us. And she said, you know, I don't want to sell this flat because I had grown up in this flat, you know, and my mum had done it up how it is. And then it clicked with me that this lady had so much more right to that flat than I did because I had lived there 10 years, but she must have lived there 30, 40 years. And so I've come to terms with that now. I'm so pleased that that coincidence happened, that I'm not still yearning, you know, for this room and the flat how I remember it, but I know the reality behind it, so I'm not yearning for it anymore. That was very lucky for me.
Which year did you first go back to Budapest?
89. So we came out in 57, went back in 89, so it's at 32 years. Yeah, 32 year gap. So it was pretty traumatic, the sense of loss.
And where would you say you call home now?
Here, definitely here. Because this is where my family is. And England has been very good to me, so although I say how much I hated it, I've got so much to be tremendously grateful for. But it's only in my old age that I can recognize that. And it's only now that I can see how much I love London, for example. Every time I come in from Watford, it gives me a kick to be here. It gives me a kick to be here. Yeah, so luckily, you know, I'm gradually coming to terms with that this is home. It's taken a long time.
Tell me a little bit about your daughters. What are they doing at the moment?
Well, the older one is exactly the same age as you. She was born in 74. Yes?
That's right. Yeah, that's
36.
My age. Yeah.
She is an actuary, and she works for PricewaterhouseCoopers. She's a director there, so she's done very nicely. She's married, and she's got a little boy, 14 months old. He's called George after my father, and I was very touched that they decided to call him after my father. And my younger daughter, Felicity, is 31. And she's a fast-track civil servant, but at the moment she's on maternity leave because she's got a 4-month-old little girl called Rebecca, and she's married to a New Zealander called Vaughan, and they live in Kew. The other daughter lives in Bishop Stortford. So Watford is sort of 1 hour in opposite directions to see them. I suppose Eric and I see our daughters as our biggest achievement in life. We are very proud of them.
How does your family view your experience of going on the plinth?
I think they were very excited for me. They really were. And they came at 4 a.m. to see me. So yes, it was a big event. And after we stood on the plinth, actually, if you really want the truth, because I like my own comforts, and it was 4 a.m, we took out some rooms in the, is it called the Trafalgar Hotel? It's the one with which the fourth plinth had special arrangements. I think we had 2 bedrooms there. So because it would have been so awful to come in from all these different places at 4 a.m. So we actually met, I think, at night, and then we all got up at 4 a.m. And then after I had stood on the plinth, we all went back to the hotel, and they were very sweet because they provided coffee and croissants, and then later on breakfast. So it was a very nice experience. We were not roughing it.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you very much for the interview today.
That's a pleasure. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we end?
No. Have you got what you wanted, though?
Yes, certainly.
Good.
Thank you.
Good.